Good day and welcome to the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Director Phil Keith. Please go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon and thank you for joining us today. I call the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and Administration of Justice to order. On behalf of General Barr, we thank you for joining us today for this important commission teleconference meeting. I, like Paul, hope you had a very beneficial and restful weekend as we come back together this week for our series of teleconferences. As I mentioned last week, we're on track to continue this schedule of conference calls with 2 to 3 calls per week through at least May the 18th. We are exploring an in-person meeting in June if the situation with COVID-19 continues to improve. We've heard from many of you about having a traditional face-to-face commission hearing, and we will continue to work toward that end as our country makes progress toward the COVID-19 virus. We're also meeting and exceeding our milestones on the timeline and feel very confident that even though we've had to accommodate significant changes to the format and our platform of the commission's work, we have not lost time toward meeting our goals, and we're making progress toward a final report. And with that, at this time, I ask our Executive Director, Dean Keeter, to conduct our roll call of commissioners.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before I call the roll, I'd like to remind everyone that today's hearing is open to the press and for any members of the media on the call. If you have questions or need clarification on anything, please contact Christina Mastropasqua in the Justice Department Office of Public Affairs. And with that, I'll begin the roll. Commissioner Babich. Commissioner Clemens.
Present.
Commissioner Evans.
Here.
Commissioner Frazier. Commissioner Galtieri.
I'm here.
Commissioner Hawkins. Commissioner Lombardo.
Here, thank you.
Commissioner McDonald.
Good afternoon, present.
Commissioner Moody.
Here.
Commissioner Parr.
I'm present.
Commissioner Price.
Good afternoon, I'm here.
Commissioner Ramsey.
Here.
Commissioner Rausch.
I'm here.
Commissioner Samaniego.
I'm here.
Commissioner Smallwood.
I'm here.
Vice Chair Sullivan.
Here.
And Commissioner Washington.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes the roll call.
Thank you. Any other announcements today, Dean?
No, sir. We are good to go.
Thank you. Today and tomorrow, the commissioners will complete the testimony on the topic of reentry, and then we'll shift our focus on Thursday to a panel on grant funding and processes. All commissioners should have the bios and testimonies for this panel, and as a reminder, we'll be posting all these materials on the Law Enforcement Commission website. Once again, we all know the commissioners and working group members are making substantial sacrifices to meet the demands of this commission's work. And we continue to acknowledge everyone's commitment, efforts, and contributions to meet the goals of this historic commission. On behalf of Attorney General Barr, we thank each of you. As noted in previous calls, we encourage commissioners to take notes during the testimony of the panels. And then when we complete the questions, when we complete the testimony, we'll have questions for our witnesses. Our first distinguished panelist is B.J. Pack, who's the United States Attorney for the Northern District of Georgia. U.S. Attorney Pack has had a tremendous amount of success employing the Project Safe Neighborhoods model in his district. We look forward to hearing more from him. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Pack. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Keith, Madam Vice Chair Sullivan, and members of the Commission. Let me first off thank you for providing me an opportunity to provide testimony regarding our office's reentry program, which is part of our Project Safe Neighborhoods strategy. As you have noted, my name is BJ Pack. I am the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Georgia. And in this role, I have the distinct pleasure and honor to serve a federal district that encompasses 46 counties north of Georgia with more than 6.4 million people, which includes our everyday heroes who work at more than 200 law enforcement agencies located in our district. In this role, and interestingly, my previous role as a policymaker, I had an opportunity to work on issues that impact law enforcement and, in general, criminal justice and criminal justice reform measures, and I've done that for several years. One of the most important aspects of criminal justice reform, which is to have a result where we reduce crime and also to produce productive citizens, the focus has been on reentry. That is, looking at ways to assist those that were incarcerated and reentering society and how they could turn out to be productive citizens and to lower recidivism. And if done correctly, these efforts will lead to obvious benefits such as decreasing recidivism, but in overall in making our community safer. And in conceptualizing our reentry program, I first focused, I noted, the report in the 2018 update on prisoner recidivism that the Bureau of Justice Statistics reported. And that report noted that 68% of prisoners nationally are rearrested within 3 years. So in conceptualizing our program, we tried to beat this number, meaning lower this number of recidivisms. And of course, the characteristics of the offenders varied across the country and time in numerous factors. Our Applied Research Services, which is our PSN research partner, they computed and looked at kind of the data for the state of Georgia for the year 2016 and found the same proportion of rearrests. Along with multiple arrests before incarceration, 70% of those who were rearrested in Georgia were arrested more than once after their release. And it also showed that males, younger individuals, people of color, and those who are undereducated have a harder time reintegrating compared to those who were similarly situated. I then instructed my staff to research database reentry programs that targeted this demographic, because these were the demographic that are the highest risk of reoffending. And after thorough research and based on kind of our successful experience with credible messenger in the context of prevention, we looked at adopting a program that deploy credible messengers to those offenders who are about to reenter society coming from institutions. A brief description of the credible messenger, it basically matches young people who have high risk of criminally offending with credible messengers. That is, people who are trained and we have experiences that young people at high risk go through to serve as mentors. They're typically people who previously served substantial sentences in state or federal prison and have dedicated themselves to reducing recidivism. And unlike other mentoring initiatives, critical messengers are, quote-unquote, wounded healer, so that they're uniquely qualified to connect with the individuals that we're targeting. And although there's some limited research to date, there's several impactful studies that show very promising outcomes. For example, the Credible Messenger Program, the Arches Transformative Mentoring Program in New York, showed a 69% lower felony arrest rate after 12 months of participation and 57 months lower felony arrest rate after 24 months. A 2017 study by the Urban Institute showed that this Credible Messenger approach yielded increased engagement with programs, increased compliance, improved relationship between stakeholders, and reduction in rearrest and violation, gun violence, and any types of antisocial behavior. So this gave us some confidence to employ this in the reentry context. So the actual program was that as follows. We launched the program. We first funded some training for our credible messenger partners that we worked with, that we trusted and vetted, along with our community outreach specialists. And then we retained our independent research partner to help structure our credible messenger program in terms of targeting and tracking. And so basically in 2018, in July, our adult reentry initiative began in the Metro Reentry Facility here in Atlanta with the Georgia Department of Corrections, with young men serving at the last 12 to 18 months of incarceration for for violent crimes or gun-related offenses or gang-affiliated criminal offense. Now, the demographics of these participants are a majority were males, black, at the highest and the greatest risk of recidivism. The combined age was 30, 21% of their previous 669 combined arrests were for violent crimes. Only 6% were married, more than half had children, quarter had graduated high school, and only half could read at an eighth grade level. And of course, 35% were employed by the time they were arrested and incarcerated. 51% were validated members of violent gangs, including Crips, Bloods, Gangsters, Disciples, Ghostface, and Goodfellas. Now, when we surveyed these individuals, they identified the most pressing needs that they had. 93% identified employment being the number one barrier. 83% identified need for health care. 80% identified need for support network. 70% identified need for transportation, obtaining identification, and also for housing. 91% of the participants recognized that they needed a mentor or life coach to achieve their goals. That's exactly what we've done. We designed a program where the program with the credible messengers lasts 6 months, in which they meet on a weekly basis to focus on cognitive behavior assessment, development, and rapport with the credible messengers. And the last three focus on job skills and reincorporating with the family through counseling and sessions where they learn life skills and the challenges that they face as they go back into society. On the employment front, which is a major hurdle, they had to have extended training on some of the life skills, such as financial literacy, credentialing. The hardest part about getting a job for the reoffender was that there's no official list of kind of employers who are willing to say that they hire returning citizens. So the credible messengers played a very important role in matching and finding through their direct relationship with these employers to give these individuals a chance at employment. Even after graduating from the program, credible messengers serve as a mentor role and a support system by encouraging them and solving problems to make sure that they stay on the right track. Upon graduating from the program, you know, the private sector partners provided each of the graduates with a new business suit, shirt, and a tie. And then the credible messengers then helped them preparing for the interview and getting the interview and stay on track. To date, 25 graduates have been released from our program, which started in mid-2018, 60% of whom are doing well, are in regular contact with their mentors. While releases have staggered throughout 19, I'm happy to report that most program participants have been out of prison for longer than 6 months. Two have exceeded a year, and after release, 70% found employment. And although four have reoffended, but they were none for violent crimes. This is significantly lower than the national and the state average. As you can see, the program shows great promise, but more study is needed. Therefore, I make the following recommendations for a jurisdiction that's looking for a credible messenger program. Number one, for an effective community messenger reentry program, a long-term commitment to train and support the credible messengers necessary. So I recommend that recruiting, vetting, and retaining critical messengers and investment in training of these individuals to last for a period of at least 3 years. Second, funding or grant resources for nonprofit organizations working with this population needs to last longer than a year-to-year grant process to provide stability and long-term planning and investment. And number three, we need to fund a research partner to serve as an independent evaluator for the program and evaluate the outcomes to make sure that data tracking and reviews for continuous quality improvement is maintained. To sum up, there's a phrase that the credible messengers often cite to that sums up recidivism in general. They say, hurt people, hurt people. The program is directed towards healing those reentering society by providing skills necessary to deal with issues, by providing a support system to disrupt the cycle of recidivism. For those of you who are most interested in more information, please refer to the appendix that I've submitted along with my written testimony, or visit our website at www.justice.gov/USAO-NDGA/PSN, where there are contact information for experts in this area. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to the panel.
Thank you, Mr. Pack, for your informative testimony and certainly your service to our country. Our next panelist is Director Nate Brown, who serves as Director of Programs at the Oklahoma Department of Corrections. Director Brown, thank you for joining us today, and you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman, Vice Chairman, members of the Commission, for the opportunity to talk about the Second Chance implementation at the Cape Bernard Correctional Center. My name is Nate Brown. I'm the Director of Programs for the Oklahoma Department of Corrections. I'm currently overseeing programs for all 24,000 inmates that we have in our 24 state facilities. We also have inmates in our three private facilities. Programs unit covers education, substance use treatment, cognitive behavioral programming, vocational programming, volunteer and religious services, reentry services. One of the reentry is the big topic that we want to talk about. So just to give a little headway, we had about 9,000 discharges last year, and we're on track for that as well for this next year. We talk about reentry as a whole, and we say that reentry here begins at reception, so that essentially everything that we're doing addresses some sort of area that we have identified as an area of need for these inmates. One of the other big things is we develop a reentry plan that's specific, that it covers it all inclusive together. So part of that reentry planning includes identification, residence, transportation, finances, social support, legal issues, registration requirements, employment, program referrals for treatment, what kind of family and relationships obligations do they have, other services like veteran and tribal services if they have that available, and the mental health needs, and then obviously if they have any kind of post-supervision requirements. But it's collectively that we're trying to make the whole better person, and we know that the two components that make them the most successful on the outside is education and employment. And we're not just talking about employment, just general employment. We're talking about long-term, steady, viable employment that is going to allow the offender to sustain themselves or their family, whatever they need. The education unit, which is what I'm here to talk about, is for the Second Chance. Currently, is the largest unit in programs. We have over 80 certified teachers that has an average of 23 students per teacher. Our current enrollment is 1,840. That's 1,399 in regular education, which consists of literacy, pre-high school education, high school education, and an additional 441 in college programming. We also have our teachers also provide life skills reentry programming, so they are doing that as well. We have 7 current college and university partners, and they operate in 13 of our state-run facilities. And if our fiscal year, which runs from July to June, had in FY19, we had 658 participants in college programs. And out of that, we awarded 20 degrees, 17 associates, and 3 bachelor's degrees. Our Second Chance schools, we currently have 2 partners, and that's Tulsa Community College and Langston University, which we started in 2016. Two more of our partners got approved for the Second Chance Pale starting soon, and one of them is Rose State College, and we're really excited about both of them, but Rose State is already operating in 7 of our facilities using interactive TV services, so the addition of the Pell Grant should allow us to expand those services quite greatly. But one of the we were asked to talk specifically about Cape Bernard, the facility and how we implemented the program there. Cape Bernard is a 250-bed female facility here in Oklahoma City. It has the benefit of being close to the city, so it has a lot more resources than some of the facilities that are located in our rural areas. We found that it's a feeder, it's a smaller facility that feeds off of our 2 larger female institutions. So people would get regular education services and then they would come to Cape Bernard, and there was no college partnerships there. So we reached out to Langston, and we decided that it would be excellent after an excellent resource for the offenders there to be able to pursue college, and Langston University actually has an outreach here that's not too far from the facility itself. So it seemed like a mutually beneficial need. We already had an MOA in place because they were operating at one of our other facilities. We brought it in. We had more than 80 inmates at the time apply or express interest in it and apply for it. We started out, this is our second semester right now, which has been a little bit hampered by the COVID-19 outbreak, but we're still continuing on with it. We had three on-site classes in the first semester, and we're down to one this semester, but we're making some adjustments to allow college coordination with one of our certified teachers that's there in the facility. So with that, I'm going to get into the recommendations that we had, specifically retaining to educational services. Any kind of first, conduct a study or funding that supports technological advances in providing educational and employment resources to correctional systems for the purposes of reentry. Anything, sometimes we operate in the dark days, so any kind of technology or infrastructure resource that supports technology in a correctional setting is going to be extremely beneficial for correctional services. The second recommendation was conduct studies of the types of college programs offered to incarcerated individuals versus the needs of business industry with focus on high-demand fields. So we want to make sure that the college programs that we are offering actually tie into something that is going to be a relatable job source down the road. The next recommendation we have is support the external Pell Initiative expansion and consider ways to aid in funding the project. Obviously, with a partnership like this, it's great, but more is more, and we could expand our offerings. If at a 250 bed facility we found 80 participants, we could expand that across our system greatly. The next recommendation is support efforts to reduce restrictive policies and rules regarding licensure relative to crime, especially in high demand areas. For example, there's a lot of conditions where you couldn't get any kind of license for, like, if they, education, even if it was a low-level offense in some states. So any kind of effort that helps reduce licensure restrictions would be beneficial. The next recommendation was to study ways that would allow long-distance transfers of releasing inmates to high employment demand areas, including interstate opportunities. If we have offenders coming out and the jobs are far away, then maybe a way to coordinate and translate that so that the bodies get to where the jobs are, so to speak. The next recommendation was provide more funding for all-inclusive services and community-directed, dedicated to reentry, incorporating employment, education, and treatment services, particularly in rural areas. We have several one-stop reentry sites here in the metro areas in Oklahoma, in Oklahoma City and Tulsa and, Lawton, but we have a whole lot of rural areas that there's gaps. We have large chunks of the state where there's just not much there. The next recommendation was research and funding for infrastructure and technology that can promote distance learning opportunities for justice-involved individuals, particularly in rural areas. Here, again, in our own state, even the Department of Corrections, we've got probation and parole sub-offices that don't have good Internet service out there. So if we're having difficulty getting Internet service, then it may be difficult as well for any kind of offender that wants to do any kind of distance learning or technology training. And the last recommendation that we had was research and expand opportunities for technology sector training, education, and employment for justice-involved individuals such as coding and software development. We house one of the last-mile coding programs here in Oklahoma, here in Mabel Bassett Correctional Center, which is not too far outside of the city. But it's training inmates on the software coding, which is a high-demand job that can often be done remotely once they get out. It's a very successful program. Again, it's one of those things that if we can match the offender to the available jobs and then train them for that down the road, that will be a boon to where we need to be. In closing, I'd like to say that as a department, we are maximizing the resources available to provide the programming opportunities to every inmate. This includes maximizing any available resource partnership and collaboration to the fullest extent. It's part of our mission to encourage positive change in offender behavior by providing rehabilitation programs and enabling successful reentry. partnerships like the one with Langston and the Second Chance Pell Initiative help make that possible. So we really appreciate that. If anybody wants any more information, they can reach out to me. My information is on the Oklahoma Department of Corrections webpage. Thank you to the commission for the opportunity to speak to you guys.
Thank you, Director Brown, for your valued testimony and your service. Dan, you want to make the announcement?
Yes, sir. And all speakers who are doing the questions are actually in an open line capacity, so any questions from the speakers, we don't need to facilitate the Q&A by pressing star 1 since they're already in a talk listen mode, unless we are intending to take participants' questions.
Thank you, Dan. And I would ask that everybody check their mic, phone, make sure it's on mute unless you're talking. Our final panelist today is Mr. John Wetzel, who's the Secretary of Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. Secretary Wetzel has had a distinguished career and now serves on the Oversight Committee to the Federal First Step Act. Secretary Wetzel, thank you for joining us today, and you're recognized.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, and certainly appreciate the work you are doing. I know this work has been difficult in general, but especially the past 8 weeks, 10 weeks, whatever it is, it's been exceedingly difficult. So I really want to commend you all for continuing these meetings and this important work. Now, I am the Secretary of Corrections for the state of Pennsylvania. I've been in this position for 9 years. I oversee a prison system that has about 44,000 inmates in 25 prisons. In addition to that, I also oversee state parole, which has about 41,000 individuals on parole in the community and about 18,000 employees. So I just want to briefly kind of touch on our approach to reentry, and it's a broad approach. We don't look at reentry as a program. We look at reentry as a progression. And I think the best way to understand how we want to think about individuals entering the community, and in Pennsylvania, we're talking about 20,000 people leaving our prisons every year. We want to think about it by reverse engineering it and looking at what are the characteristics of people who come in our front door. And like my colleagues alluded to, there's a couple things that really hop out. Number one, vast majority, 40% of the folks who come into our prisons don't have a high school diploma. Education is a key component of keeping people out of the correction system or the criminal justice system and being successful citizens. Addiction, 70%, and that's probably lowballing it because that's a self-reported number of individuals are suffering from a substance use disorder, and 21% of those, or 21% of our new commitments are suffering from an opioid addiction, which is a significant increase over the past 10 years, and I think that's probably pretty consistent all over the place. The third characteristic of our population is it's folks who suffer from significant mental illness, and that's nearly a third of our population. Those three areas are all very challenging, and they're not discrete, right? So there's a lot of overlap between those groups. Some other characteristics, I think my colleague from Georgia alluded to, some of the unemployability is how I would call it. People who don't have a long work history, if any, or certainly not legal work history, I should say, and that presents a challenge. You know, for someone to be a successful human being on the back end of our system, they're going to have to be able to be adequately employed. And then the final thing is an alarming number of our new commitments suffer from homelessness coming in. So for that reason, and further how we think about reentry is a continuum. My colleague from Oklahoma talked about how reentry begins at the front door, and it truly does. And I asked the commission to consider thinking about reentry as a process that does begin when someone comes in, and it really begins with assessing what are the criminogenic factors that led to them committing a crime in the first place. So some of the things we all mentioned, addiction, mental illness, underemployment, those kinds of things, oftentimes are driving forces in employment in some people and not others. So for us to have someone leave our system less likely to commit a crime when they came in, and make no bones about it, that's what our goal should be, to make someone less likely to commit a crime. Then we have to address those needs on an individual basis. And it's one of the reasons why we've had historically such terrible outcomes, is because it can't be a paint-by-number situation. You have to individualize it, and you have to localize it as important. Pennsylvania, like many states, is very big and very varied. So what a reentry plan, especially as it relates to employment, looks for someone going back to Philadelphia versus Pittsburgh versus the center part of the state are all very different. And if we think that we can take one approach for that, we're going to continue to fall short on those things. So, you know, our first thing around employment that we did through a Department of Ed grant from several years ago is really identifying at assessment, at when new commits come in, is assessing what their interests are as far as employment, what their aptitude and ability is, and then try to provide vocational services to them that are consistent with what they have the ability to do. But as important, through this grant, we created a strategic partnership with our folks at Labor and Industry to look specifically at what jobs are available in the area the individual is going back to. Like I said, on the federal level, I would think that this would be very relevant because obviously your Federal Bureau of Prisons sends people back to all 50 states. If you're providing vocational programming for a job that's not present in the state the individual is going back from, I'm not sure you've made progress. And the ancillary part of this is that when we spend money on reentry, which I think we need to spend money on, we should spend it wisely. We should spend it on something that's going to move the needle as it relates to outcome. So from the employment standpoint, that's critical. But before you even get to that, addressing the addiction and the mental illness issues are significant. In both of those cases, that programming needs to follow them in the community, but all of this needs to start while they're incarcerated. And so we view the incarcerated period as a time to build the building blocks for success. So addressing thinking areas and some of the cognitive behavioral things that the vast majority of people who come in with, and then addressing specific needs around addiction. We've been a state that's really doubled down on using medication-assisted treatment, especially Vivitrol, for people coming out with opioids and connecting them to that infrastructure in the community. And we do therapeutic communities at most of our prisons. As it specifically relates to reentry on the back end, the number one challenge, even pre-COVID, is housing for these individuals and sustainable housing. We've been able to mitigate that through the use of halfway houses, and we even create a housing voucher program. I'll mention in halfway houses, I think a best practice is certainly performance contract our halfway houses. In other words, we pay the providers of halfway house services based on the recidivism rate of people who go through there. So if they lower the recidivism rate, they get a bonus. If they keep it within one standard deviation of the average, they get their normal pay. And if the recidivism rate of people who go through those halfway houses increase in two successive six-month periods, I fire them. And I think that's the kind of critical. I think incentives work when we partner with the private sector, and I also think that there has to be accountability for not getting outcomes if we're making this huge investment. As it relates to employment, I talked about strategic partnerships with labor and industry. But I think two of the big basic things that we have to take care of is making sure individuals have identification cards coming out of prison and they're connected to some healthcare entity, especially even pre-COVID, but especially post-COVID. We've been able to achieve this, first of all, with identifications by partnering with our Department of Transportation. We have about a 90% rate of people leaving with their state-issued identification card. And then, secondly, turning medical assistance or making sure they're reconnected with their private insurance if they have that. And, again, we have about a 75% rate with that. I think these are key components of reentry. As it relates to recommendations, I think my colleague from Oklahoma talked extensively about education. Higher ed in prison is a no-brainer. I think that what we found is it's been a mutually beneficial partnership. and that some universities, especially some community colleges, really benefit from the partnership. I think we should really focus on assessing educational needs, providing education, and related to that, technical education, which is an underserved area, and certainly, before COVID was an underserved area. So I really think that that's a critical piece of the puzzle, and implicit in that is that we partner with labor and industry and the labor folks, so we understand what the employment needs are in the community. Secondly, addiction. I think that the use of medication-assisted treatment, creating a continuum of care, and those kinds of things for individuals suffering from addiction is a critical piece of it. I think that removing barriers and identification is an example of that. Getting someone an identification card, which is admittedly much more difficult at the federal level than the state level, is a critical piece, and it will be a barrier. I mean, you can't buy cough syrup without an ID. I don't know how we can expect someone to be successful without an ID. And then the big one is housing. And we've done some things using halfway houses with some, frankly, mixed results, even though we performance contract them. We've experimented fairly significantly with housing vouchers and are really working in that direction with using housing vouchers coupled with mentoring similar to the federal program the gentleman from Georgia discussed with having a mentor who has credibility to the individual and help them through the housing thing. I would just quickly mention as I wrap up here that it's really important as you're talking about reentry that we really reset our expectations coming out of this COVID situation. And I'll tell you specifically the impact it's had on Pennsylvania. Prior to COVID, we had a 65% employment rate for people on parole. And that's in a large part because of the things I talked about, starting when they come to the door and those kinds of things. That's dropped well below 50%, and by next month, I assume that's going to be 30%. Our halfway houses and using halfway houses for housing is a completely different dynamic now. We have 35 halfway houses. We currently have 7 that aren't taking new commitments because they're in quarantine because of COVID. So I think that this is important work, and I think reentry in general is a challenge, but I think a key piece of this and one of the things you may want to think about is the impact that COVID has had and will continue to have over the next 18 to 24 months on reentry. With that, I'll wrap up, and thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Secretary Wetzel, for your testimony and your distinguished service. Commissioners, we are now open for questions for the witnesses. Commissioners with questions, please state your name prior to your question and direct the question to a specific panelist. Or if it's for a response from the entire panel, please state so. Just as a reminder to the commissioners, your mics are hot at all times. With that, thank you, and commissioners, we're open for questions. Commissioners with questions for our panelists.
Bill, this is Erica McDonald. May I ask a question, please?
Yes, ma'am, you're recognized.
Thank you very much. BJ, hi, it's Eric McDonald. I have a question for you. Are there any other U.S. Attorney's offices that have had a credible messenger program such as this? I hadn't heard of it until I heard about your work, which sounds fantastic. And do you know of any either state or local that have had such a similar success with a credible messenger program?
Well, I don't know if there's any other of our colleagues have adopted a program like this. I will mention, I think that it's catching on at the state level. One of the benefits that we had, and I think the commissioners are going to hear from the warden of the Metro Reentry Facility that we're partnering with, but it takes more than just, seed funding and few personnel to kind of make this work. And so it's daunting in that context. And our relationship with the DOC, the Department of Corrections here, as the other two panelists have said, I think that that's the reason why our program has at least shown some great promise in the beginning. I'm willing to share my information, what we've done, and what kind of errors and trials and tribulations that we went through with anybody who would like information on that. But having seen this program work itself out, and I've spoken to the first graduating class, and this is different from kind of the other types of reentry initiatives that I've been involved in. I served on the state level Criminal Justice Reform Council prior to coming on board. But I hope that my testimony and information I provided would spur some other districts to kind of look at what they could do in conjunction with their local Department of Corrections.
You know, BJ, we have a reentry program here in Minnesota, and we don't have such a program. I'm really going to lean on you to look at it because I think it's great work that you're doing there. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Other commissioners with questions? Other commissioners with questions for our panelists?
Hey, Phil, this is Don Washington. A question for Mr. Brown.
Yes, sir, you're recognized.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Brown, just curious, because I had a difficult time hearing a part of your presentation, but did you address, and if you didn't, would you please address how it is that you motivate the folks who enter into the education part of the program to actually do so, and what keeps them motivated such that they get to the point, as you said, 20 of them, I guess, in last fiscal year, ended up with degrees, 17 associate, 13 bachelor. Just curious as to what is it that gets them to the point where they want to earnestly participate in the education program and then succeed at it so that they can have a better life going forward.
Thank you for the question. Motivation for most of our education is simply a matter of showing them what they can achieve on the outside, and we have success stories throughout the system that actually aid in that. We have one offender at one of our female facilities that she was incarcerated, she got her regular high school degree, she got a college degree, and then she went on, and after she graduated from college, she started college programs inside the system, but then she went on and she became an attorney, so she actually practices law in Oklahoma and Texas. So we have that. I mean, we've shifted the last few years to greatly parse out how important reentry is, and so we're honing it not just in our programs but through security and through other methods. Keeping the inmates motivated to be there, obviously we have, you know, behavior issues sometimes, but for those that choose to be in college, that's pretty much all self-driven. When we show offenders, you know, the earning potential down the road of what they can make with a degree and, you know, better provide for themselves and for their families when they get out, it's just kind of it's intuitive, and we just keep honing that along the way, and we keep, you know, all of our certified teachers just keep pushing that, and we're showing them those opportunities as they go through. Did that answer your question, Will?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Sounds like you have a fantastic program. Thank you much.
Thank you.
Other commissioners with questions for our panelists?
Chairman Keith, this is John Samaniego.
Yes, you're recognized.
I have a question for Mr. Secretary Wetzel. I noticed you had a significant career in county corrections, being a warden of a county jail, with where you significantly reduced the population there. Can you give me a outline on how you were able to do that?
Yeah, and thank you. I call my days in the county the good old days, because I really loved that environment. And the blueprint for that was really pretty basic. And I will tell you a little bit about Franklin County, Pennsylvania. It's a small rural county, very conservative, conservative Christian county. Like two-thirds of the voters are straight ticket Republicans. And with a significantly growing jail population. So we really identified what the drivers of the population were, and in many cases it was programming needs, it was addiction, it was the kind of stuff we talked about today. One of the kind of urban legends of that area was that the individuals in jail were mostly from out of the area. Franklin County is at the intersection of Route 30 and Route 81, so the assumption was most of the folks were from out of the area. When we looked at the data, We saw that, in fact, the vast majority of folks were not only from Franklin County, but were born within 50 miles of Franklin County at a rate of about 65%. So we engaged the religious community. They really bought in and understood the value in really trying to get people out of the system altogether and doing it without just using incarceration. And so we focused on creating a programming infrastructure to include a day reporting center and use treatment as the number one thing when it could be used and we could ensure public safety. We started doing some pretrial risk assessment even back in 2007 before folks were talking about it. We started doing it, and not in a complicated way. We actually used interns from a local university to help us do that. And we were able to really target who needed to be incarcerated. And we reduced recidivism by providing these programs, and the combination of those two helped us reduce our population by about 20%. Thanks for that question.
Thank you for the response. That's a significant event.
Other commissioners with questions for our panelists? Other commissioners with questions for our panelists? Hearing no further questions, let me close by thanking our panelists once again for your time and your most valuable testimony and responses to the questions from our commissioners. On behalf of Attorney General and his leadership team of Rachel Bissick and Jeff Avita, and all the commissioners, your contributions provided today are most sincerely appreciated and will assist the commission in their deliberations and work. Before we close, just a reminder that our next two hearings this week will be on Wednesday and Thursday, as we will wrap up the hearings on reentry tomorrow and then shift our focus on Thursday to criminal justice grants and processes. Also, please check the President's Commission page for additional updates of documents and information on the main justice website. We'll update that regularly when information is made available for posting. We want to thank the FBI for their continued support for providing their teleconference network to the Commission, and certainly all the federal program managers for working diligently behind the scene to support the efforts of the Commission and the working groups. Any questions or comments from the commissioners? If there's no further business before us today, the President's Commission is adjourned. Thank you again, commissioners, for your dedication.